Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. We are chatting art, transport, communications and history, that's CATCH, it's the Catchcast, and we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful geeky subjects as our amazing guests. In this edition, could you have a book in you? We're discovering the role of the author. We're finding out about how they do their research and what role the publishers play. Today we're joined by someone who knows all of this inside out. He's one of Britain's most prolific railway historians, the very venerable John Scott Morgan. Welcome to the Catchcast.
Hello there.
Thanks so much for being on the show, John. We want to know all about your fascinating life in publishing, but we want to start by taking you right back a bit and ask how you got interested in railways and transport, please.
Oh, I've always been interested in railways and transport. My family were connected with the railways quite heavily. In fact, from research, the earliest person in my family who was actually involved with the railway industry was a person who joined the Taff Vale Railway in 1836 as a blockman.
Crikey.
And most of them worked on the Great Western. But my main interest is the Southern, would you believe?
There you go. And can you talk about what the transport scene was like when you were a kid?
It was quite fascinating, actually, because there was an awful lot of equipment from the 19th century still in use, including locomotives and rolling stock in some cases. And there was an awful lot of stuff. It was like a layer cake all the way through the 20s, 30s, and all the way through to the modern day, as it was then in the 50s and 60s when I was a kid at school.
It must have been fascinating to see how things changed from when you were a kid, the steam age, if you like, to that era when British Rail dawned in 1965.
Yes, it was, actually. It was a huge changeover, actually. It wasn't just the coat of blue paint, basically, and blue and grey carriage stock. It was more than that. The whole culture and ethos of the whole thing changed.
And did you have any idea when you were watching this happen that that particular era that you were talking about growing up in, the 1950s and 60s, the end of steam, if you like, would become so important for railway enthusiasts now?
Well, no, not at that time, but that there was a huge shortage of money in the 1960s. I mean, the average salary in those days was £15 a week.
Wow.
So if you were trying to fight to save something, it was a hell of an uphill battle. British railways were not very generous to the preservation movement. They would sell locomotives to scrap dealers for a fraction of the cost of a locomotive they would sell to a preservation group. I actually think they did it purposely to put people off preserving things.
That wouldn't surprise me in that era.
Yes. There was this obsession with the future. And if you turn around to them and say, well, what is the future in that sense? How can you think about the future without respecting the best of the past? Because without the past, you won't have a future. They would look at you quite blankly, frankly.
Very sad. Do you have any thoughts about when you were young, you might pursue your transport fascination in later life?
Not in the way it's happened. I knew that I'd probably stay with it all my life. It isn't an obsession, it's a passion, which is very different. But no, I never thought I'd actually be involved at the sharp end, as it were, in helping to produce books and things like that. And in fact, I've been involved with preserving a number of locomotives as well.
Could you maybe tell us about your career before you got involved in books? What did you do?
A number of jobs, actually. When I first left school, I worked for Mercedes-Benz Great Britain Limited for a year. I didn't like the motor trade very much, so I left there and I ended up working in a research library in the Stock Exchange through a friend of mine. And I stayed there for 2.5 years. When the Heath government lost the election, I then went into local government for a time.
Right. So can you talk us through the process? What was your thinking going on when you came up with the idea for your first book?
Well, it's a funny story, actually. When I was a kid at school, Ian Allen reprinted some of the loco number books from the 1940s. I was never a train spotter, actually, but the locomotive number books are useful for research. The original books, they had very muddy photographs. They weren't very good. But there was a picture that always fascinated me in the Great Western book on the Corris Railway. It showed the two locomotives at Mice Poeth, where the engine shed is. and I was fascinated by it. I don't know why. The thought of this strange little slate railway being owned by the Great Western from Paddington. And I decided in the early 1970s to do a book on it, on the railway itself. There had been a little book published in 1948 when the line closed by a chap called Lewis Cousins, but the Corris Railway Society reprinted that. But it was very limited, the book, to be honest, because he couldn't get his hands on the archives at the time. But the thing is that I had the luck, of course, by that time, a lot of the railway archives were with the Public Records Office and had been available through British Railways, actually. So I started work on this book, and I was very lucky. I was in the Model Railway Club in London, the oldest model railway club in Britain. And one of the members there was a chap called Ted Wade, who's sadly dead now. He was a graphic designer and an architect. And he had written a book about the Plynlimmon Hafan Tramway, which was another obscure Welsh railway that was only open for 1 year, would you believe? But I said, well, are you interested in this Corris book I'm doing? And he said, yes. And in 1977, my first book came out, which was the Corris Railway Company.
Wow. So once you'd given birth to the idea of doing the book and you started researching it, you had that great fortune of finding some archives. How did you go about finding a publisher back then in the 1970s? How did it all work?
In that case, I was at the MRC exhibition, which was in Central Hall in Westminster. He turned up on the stand and I said, I'm doing this book on the Corris, are you interested? And he said yes. I'd had three articles published in the Great Western Echo, which is the journal of the Great Western Society, on the Corris, and much expanded it into a book. And luckily he was a very open-minded person, and he took the risk of publishing me as a young man. I was 18.
Wow, you certainly did fall on your feet there, because a lot of people have problems finding their first publisher. Now, your books, we're going to talk about more of them in a bit, but your books have quite a lot of lovely images, not unlike some of mine, maps as well. How do you go about finding historic images, and what are some of the pitfalls of using pictures in books?
Years ago when I started, it was a lot easier because there were a lot of people selling photographs. People like Lens of Sutton. John Smith had a shop in Westmead Road, in Carshalton. There were other people, like the Real Photographic Company, who sold you stuff. And Ian Allen had their negatives sold through a chap who ran a business in Broadstairs. LPC Pictures, Loco and General Pictures. You could get pictures of private individuals who were still alive then. You could also get maps from various sources. Things were very good in those days, actually, when you look back. What's happened is a lot of these collections have, in some cases, been lost, in other cases sold off, and then sold on eBay. Many of the collections were catalogued, and that's almost a form of vandalism to do that. Mm. But it's very often a family who are not interested in transport, and they think, oh, Uncle Dick's pictures, let's just sell them on eBay, which is an awful thing to do. Mm. But the worst thing of all, which really annoys me now, is that some of the national museums get their hands on these collections and won't let anyone use them. Mm. Or they charge £50 a picture. If I had been faced with that at the age of 18, I could never have written the Corris Railway Company.
Goodness. So, John, you've sweated with all your research, the books with the publisher. What happens next?
Well, basically, it goes through the various processes. When you've handed the book in and they've approved it and they like what you've done, it goes through to the production department and they do all the design work, the photographic work, dealing with all the graphic design and what have you. They then arrange for it to go to a printer to be printed. Very often these days abroad, because British printers are so expensive. Mm-hmm. In China or India mostly, believe it or not.
Wow.
And then after that it's bound, shipped back to this country, and then it's released for publication.
John, you talked us through the preliminary stages of production. And can you describe to us the feelings you have once that initial pristine first copy comes back to you from the publishers?
It normally comes back in the form of three proofs that you have to go through and check because the printers, they don't get things wrong, but they often put typos in and all kinds of things. One of the problems we've had from printers abroad is some of them try to rewrite your stuff in American English, which is good fun, which you've got to correct into English. But when the book is actually properly released, after you've gone through the proof stage and it's been printed and all the rest of it, it's always a thrill to me when the books arrive. You get 6 free copies. And when you open that parcel, it's quite something to see them, I can tell you.
Well, I do know that feeling myself from doing my own books. But for the listeners who perhaps thinking maybe they might do a book one day themselves, it's difficult to describe how good that feeling is, eh?
It is, because all the other processes before it, in terms of researching and writing the book, finding the material and doing all the proofreading and everything, it's quite arduous, I can tell you.
Yeah, it can be quite laborious. What's the next thing that an author does then after those first books come out?
Well, basically, I mean, I try to get signing days at preserved railways or bookshops. That's a big game, I can tell you. It's very difficult. Without being rude to the preservation movement, some of the preserved railways, they seem to employ people, volunteers or even paid, who are not very helpful about this sort of thing, even if the book is relevant to their railway, and obviously that's an important criteria. You often find rather switched off people running these shops.
Oh dear.
Whether it's a high street shop, and there aren't that many of those left now, or it's a preserved railway with a bookshop, you either find they're very helpful or you find at times they're very switched off and they just say go away, in effect.
Oh dear.
Yes.
So how does an author find out about how their book's doing? Are there weekly sales figures?
Because I work for a publisher, I can get sales figures, but the author can ring them up and say, how is it doing? You know, how is it going? And they'll usually send you an email or a letter telling you how many have been sold.
Okay, that's helpful to know. And what about payment, John? How do authors normally get any income for their hard work?
Some publishers only pay once a year and other publishers pay twice a year. We pay twice a year, the publisher I work for.
And their royalties or buyouts, how does that work?
Well, in most cases, you get an advance, normally between £500 or £1,000 if you're doing the sort of book I write. That's to buy photographs and buy the reproduction fees for them. But after that, it's 10% royalties, and it takes a while for that to come through.
Sure, because you've got to wait for the ones to be sold.
You have to pay for the £1,000 you've had, you see, or £500.
Right, so you've got to kind of earn back the advance royalties you've already been given, yeah.
You do, and it takes a while.
So going back to the 1970s then, John, your first book was out there in the world. What happened with you next?
Oh, I had a stroke of luck. A friend of mine, who's sadly no longer with us, he was years older than me, a chap called Ivor Guthridge. He wrote to one of my main areas of interest. I have a lot of areas of interest, but one of my main areas of interest is British Light Railways and Narrow Gauge. And he wrote to David and Charles, which existed as a transport publisher in those days, and suggesting a book on Colonel Stevens Railways. And they wrote back and said, we're interested. And then he suggested me. And I had to go down to Newton Abbot from Basingstoke, where I lived at the time, to go and see them. And I saw the commissioning editor, Geoffrey Kitchenside. And we had lunch together. And he offered me the contract for my first hardback. The Corris Railway Company had been a softback, you see.
Well, that was really fortuitous then for you being introduced to David and Charles. I hope you went down by train.
I did. To change at the Exeter St. David's.
Now, you mentioned you had many interests there. We're going to come back and talk about your most recent books and also your work with the publisher. But I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about your interest in preserved railways.
Well, I've been involved with preserved railways since I was 13, actually. I joined the Great Western Society at the Taplow Open Day in 1967, and I'm a life member of that now. But I've been involved with that both before and during and now with Didcot, both as a young volunteer. But in more recent years, we had a lot of trouble over our lease because we had a rather strange arrangement where BR, as it was then, and then Network Rail, could give us 6 months' notice to quit the site. would you believe? And they wouldn't do that because it was developed, and the shed building is listed. But what happened was we tried to get a new lease with Network Rail, and they were passing the committee around like a parcel. Bristol would say, oh, talk to Reading, and Reading would say, talk to Swindon, and Swindon would say, talk to Paddington, and it would go round and round and round. I was working for a bookshop in those days called Motor Books, which doesn't exist anymore. It was in the West End of London. And I was by accident, would you believe, I was quite by chance, I was given a ticket to a book launch about 18th century military and political cartoons. And I went along, it was a sort of wine and cheese thing, and I met Lord Adonis, the transport minister, and I managed to get talking to him, and I said to him, we're having terrible trouble at getting a lease, a renewal for a proper lease. He listened to what I was saying, and unlike a lot of politicians, he was actually interested in railway history. He said, I pass that site, he said, every night. I live in Oxford, he said, and I work in London, of course, at the House of Commons. He said, I'm interested. He said, I want a letter from your chairman tomorrow morning. And thank God, I knew the chairman very well, Richard Croucher, who's an incredibly nice guy. And I rang him up at 11 o'clock. And I said, I'm sorry to ring you at 11 o'clock, but I know you've had trouble having any common sense out of Network Rail over this lease. I said, I've talked to Lord Adonis, and he wants a letter and a report from you tomorrow morning. He said he's going to do something about it.
Wow.
And Lord Adonis got us a 60-year extension on the lease.
Wow, amazing.
Without being big-headed about it, if I hadn't met him and talked to him, perhaps we wouldn't have got it.
No, that's the joy of serendipity, isn't it, John?
It is. It was.
Thank goodness you were there. And just briefly, you have an interest in other preserve railways, haven't you? Tell us something about your African connection.
Yes, I am the founder, actually, of the British Overseas Railways Historical Trust. And the reason why it was set up was, although the National Railway Museum at York has a very fine collection of British stuff, they were ignoring the fact we built railways overseas. Not only in what is now the Commonwealth, what was the Empire, but also in other parts of the world, like South America and China and all kinds of places. We built the early railways in Japan and felt quite concerned about the fact that an awful lot of stuff was literally being pushed into skips when these companies ceased to exist. And I founded the British Overseas Railways Historical Trust and helped to set it up as a charitable trust to preserve the material. But in the process of that, we were looking at trying to preserve some pieces of hardware, if you like, locomotives and rolling stock. And we were initially after a 59 Garrett locomotive from Kenya, but in waiting for one of those to come up, basically for sale, I read an article about these SPS Class 440 locos built in Britain in the 1900s, still working in Pakistan. They were British Engineering Standards Association's 440s. Mm-hmm. And they were based on a Great Central design, actually, by Pollitt. I was working at the British Council in the exam testing service, and we used to have very, very busy periods and very, very slack periods. And during the slack periods, only one of us would be in the office, and it was a Friday. And I read this article, and I actually phoned up the Pakistan embassy, and I got a chap called Sharif Katak on the end of the phone. And it led to me meeting the information minister, Dr. Aziz. I initially said, can we buy one off you for scrap? Mm. Because you're withdrawing them. And the Pakistan government gave one to us.
Wow.
But I was actually involved heavily in negotiating the deal to get it.
Thank goodness that you were there to do that. John, you've talked us through your first few titles, but so far you have produced, is it, I think, 38 books, is that right?
Yes, I have indeed.
I wanted to ask you about the most recent ones in a moment, but how did you get involved with the publishing side itself?
Quite by accident. I was working for Ian Allen, and I was approached by one of the executives at Pen and Sword, who I now work for part-time, and they asked me to join them and take over the new list for transport books, which they were going to start to launch.
That must be really interesting, being both an author and seeing the process from the publisher's side too. So what are companies like Pen and Sword looking for in new titles, would you say?
We've managed to identify areas that sell better than other areas. It was touch and go, not touch and go in the sense of losing lots of money, but we put our toes in various waters to see what would sell and what wouldn't sell. And we do find that books on things like locomotives, rolling stock, infrastructure, London, anything on London sells, anything connected with the nuts and bolts side of railways. We found certain other areas are not such good sellers.
Mm-hmm. What are the things that aren't picking up so well then?
Basically, we found books on overseas railways sadly don't sell very well. We did a few.
Okay.
And we also did, we found that we do transport as a whole, not just railways. We found that books on provincial buses and trams don't sell very well.
Okay.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
That is sad indeed, because I do love a good tram. And generally speaking, how are sales of books generally holding up in this brave new world of digital?
Not too bad. It's a bit tough at the moment, actually. I think everyone's a bit short of money, aren't they?
Mm.
But it's a little bit tough at the moment. We do our own, we've got our own warehouse. We also sell through Amazon, of course. But we have our own warehouse and we do an awful lot of our own marketing and our own direct sales. And we also do e-books for people overseas.
Now, talking of e-books, and I know this might sound like a daft question maybe, but will there always be books made of paper, do you think?
I think there will, because there was this belief about 10 years ago that the paper book was dead, and it's not true at all. People like to have a book with photographs in. They like to have a book with an attractive cover. It's not the same giving somebody as a Christmas present or birthday present a black box, basically, and saying, oh, this is a book. Not the same feeling as actually handing over a paper printed book.
No, I know. I agree with you. I hope you're right, because being a writer myself, I would love people to still keep buying books. They are very special things. So as well as your hat giving advice to the publisher, you are still researching and writing your own works. I think one of your most recent books was about the Hailing Island Railway.
Oh, Hailing Billy.
Yes.
Yes. That was about 3 or 4 years ago now. Since then, I've done a book on that, yes. But I've also done a book about the Colonel Stevens Line, the East Kent Railway. And also recently this year, a book has come out called The Light Railway, which is an overview of British light railways and Irish light railways as well.
One of your classics is Southern Railway Gallery. I think that was about 2017, wasn't it? That must have been a bit of a minefield with what you're talking about, clearing the copyright, given the way that the image registration's changed in the last few years.
It was, but in some cases, the photographs are so old that they're out of copyright, luckily.
Mm.
Basically, it's 80 years after the photographer has died, but how do you know when the person died? That's the problem.
Mm. It also depends quite how much trouble you may or may not be getting in by printing something that's old. I mean, are people going to know? Anyone going to have a go at you?
It's an open situation. What I always do is I actually put a disclaimer in the book at the end of the photo acknowledgements. And I say, I've made every endeavour to find the copyright of all these pictures in this book. However, if anyone has been left out, please contact me through the publisher.
Keeps you out of trouble.
Well, it shows that you made an effort, you see, in legal terms. Okay. You haven't just used pictures.
Yeah, of course, absolutely, willy-nilly. I mean, I'm sure there are some people that do that, some sort of more disreputable writers, not like yourself, who tries to really research it properly. And what other subjects...
It has happened in the past, I can tell you.
And what other subjects are you working on now for the future then, John, if we may ask?
Well, next January or February, I've got a book on Brighton Terrier locomotives coming out with a chap called Peter Steele. He and I are doing a book together on the Terriers, and that's in the locomotive portfolio series for Pen and Sword.
And we have some of those old Terriers still running around here on the Isle of Wight Steam Railway, don't we?
You do. You've got two of them. There are 10 preserved out of 50 that were built.
Mm-hmm.
There's one in Canada. Wadden is in the Montreal Railway Museum, but the other nine are in Britain. There are two on the Bluebell, two on the Isle of Wight Steam Railway, two on the Kent and East Sussex, one at York, and there's one at Brassingham.
That's probably not a bad preservation rate if you think about how much destruction has happened to other poor old locos and things.
It was very lucky that Billy Butlin bought four of them.
Right.
Because after 9 or 10 years of having them at holiday camps, he sold them off. And that's how the Isle of Wight Steam Railway and the other people managed to get their hands on them.
Excellent. Now, more generally, John, what advice do you have for any future bidding authors out there, even if they're not necessarily railway books?
Well, don't give up. If you get any rejections from publishers, keep going, because you will find someone who will take your book on. And basically, keep at it. That's what I would say.
Yeah, make sure you do good research and clear all your pictures.
Make sure you do good research, because there are people who are sloppy with their research. Unfortunately, once it's in a book, the public think it's for real.
Well, this really has been a fascinating whistle-stop tour of one of the most important and influential railway authors. Thanks so much for joining us on the Catchcast, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
I do hope you've enjoyed listening to John as much as I have. You can find more of his work still online. Just search for John Scott Morgan on your favourite search engine. And if you've ever thought you had a book in you, John is living proof that you can do it. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We are doing more chatting art, transport, communications history. Please join us then.